Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
So we're ready to go. We just want to hear a little more of the music. That's the way we get things started in the afternoon, kind of set the stage. And today's topic is a tough topic, but it's something that we really haven't talked about for quite a while on the show. I tend to try to focus our conversations around things that I find to be uplifting or positive or pro-mental health. And when it comes to relationships and marriages, I try to present information to try to build those relationships, make them stronger. But in many cases, no matter how hard we try or no matter how much work we put into our relationship or no matter how much we want something to work, divorce is inevitable. And so it's time to talk about what divorce looks like, because there's been so many changes in the last probably 35 years in how we approach divorce that for those of us who grew up in the 70s, at the height of the what we call the divorce epidemic, post-second wave feminist movement, we had the highest rate of divorce in the history of this country. At that time, 50% of all marriages were ending in divorce. Three-quarters of the divorces were filed by women who were newly feeling liberated and ready to take on the world by themselves. And so having grown up in that era, I think a lot of people from that generation have a very strong feeling about the devastation that comes along with divorce. Because at that time, post-second wave of feminism, what we weren't prepared for was how to help families cope with the dissolution of their marriage, dissolution of the marriage, dissolution of the family. We didn't really understand, or if we did understand, we certainly didn't talk about the impact on children and what their future would be like having gone through a divorce, the impact it would have for generations. We didn't understand what would happen to care for children. Because post-second wave feminism was about opening the door for women to have equal access to education and opportunities to get into the workforce and about being able to be autonomous and to follow their path. So women left the home in droves to go to work, to go into the corporate world or to go to work in any form. But there was no plan for how to care for the children. We didn't have to after school activities or after school programs. There's very little daycare, especially institutional daycare that existed. And so that opened up the door for a whole generation. Again, for those of you raised in the 70s, to be latchkey children. And latchkey children were the kids that came home after school with their key to their front door around their neck, opened the door, went in, ate cereal and watched TV all afternoon until their mom came home from work. And so those visions of, you know, divorce and what divorce looked like have stayed with us. You know, that the idea of the weekend dad, and there was very little protection for fathers at that time once a divorce occurred, being able to maintain some sort of visitation schedule or opportunities to see children. It was hard to enforce that in courts. So fathers quite often were losing opportunity to be with their children, or if they were with their children, it was every other weekend at their dad bachelor pad in a condo somewhere. You know, you're with me on this, right? That there is this stigma and story about divorce that really has carried on the last few decades, that stemmed from what we saw is this peak of divorce in the 70s. But things really have radically changed. Not for a long time, actually quite recently. In the last 10 years, things have radically changed. Up until the early 2000s, we still were approaching divorce in the same ways that we had since the 1950s or 1970s, that, you know, couples could no longer get along, would separate their assets, would separate the children, and the kids would just have to follow along with whatever happened. And as a result of that, we've seen a pattern of divorce that's developed in this country, because divorce, begets divorce. If you grow up in a home where your parents are divorced, you have, and the statistic's crazy high, it's like 167% likelihood that you will also go through a divorce yourself. That's a weird stat, isn't it? I know. It's a likelihood. And that number increases if both people getting married came from families of divorce. And so the odds of being able to have a long-term successful marriage having grown up in a family of divorce is quite rare. So some of the things that has been happening in the last couple of decades is to help couples who are getting married to break the pattern of divorce that came through their family system. Good news is good marriages beget good marriages. You know, healthy relationships beget healthy relationships. But where we are today in the last 10 years is that we've started to really take a close look at how to help couples navigate divorce in supporting their children, in supporting each other, in supporting their community, and to be able to come out the other side of divorce whole and different and able to carry on their lives in productive ways, to try to reduce some of the stigma and shame around going through a divorce, to try to help people understand they don't have to have a long, drawn-out legal battle in order to separate their lives. So today I've invited in my friend Jennifer Blomfield. You might remember Jennifer from our traditions conversation right around Christmas. She didn't want to talk about divorce then, and we both agreed that probably wasn't the best time to chat about divorce. So we talked about traditions, but we have been talking about having this conversation for the last 6 months because Jennifer, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist, is also a trained divorce coach and a child specialist helping parents navigate their children's future going through a divorce. And she's part of the Slow Collaborative Practice Group, helping couples to go through divorce without it becoming contentious or devastating or long and drawn out. So that's what we're going to talk about today. What are the alternatives to this vision we have of divorce from back in the day when it just was awful and everyone suffered and no one ever got over it? How can we re-envision what divorce looks like? And before we jump into it, I always like to put things in a little bit of historic context. So I just want to give you a little timeline of divorce, because almost as long as we've had the union of marriage, the contract of marriage, we've had divorce. The first recognized divorce was actually King Henry VIII in 1562, and he had to go to the Pope to get permission because his wife was not able to bear children, so he wanted to be able to have children. So that was the first divorce. But that didn't open the doors for divorce, and certainly didn't open the doors for divorce for the common people, because, you know, the idea of the family unit, the family structure, is at the heart of what makes civilization work. So for those who are in power, they see the intact family system as essential to being able to have industry and build an economy and have stability. And so leaders, rulers, religious leaders never really want to make divorce available because their fear was that that would separate out the strength of the nation. It wasn't until 1857 that the Matrimonial Clause, the Matrimonial Causes Act, was passed in the United States, which allowed regular people to apply for divorce, but still it had to be in severe cases of adultery or life-threatening abuse or insanity or desertion. And so that was actually spawned after the Revolutionary War, which I found interesting that a lot of women after the Revolutionary War and saw that the breaking from the Union, the breaking of the United States from England, was similar to them needing to break their marital unions. Once they had moved to the United States in this newfound country, they also wanted to be liberated. So there was a spike of requests for divorce between the 1820s and 1830s. But 1857 is when the matrimonial cause came into play. And then more recent history, in the 1950s, we created what was called the divorce industry, because a lot of returning soldiers after World War II, people had gotten married very quickly right before they went to war. And so there was a brief spike in divorces in the 1950s. And this divorce industry created what they called divorce mill states. So surprising, like Indiana and Utah, of all places, were and the North Dakota were divorce mill states where you could go and get a quickie divorce, which is kind of surprising. You wouldn't think Utah, but post-World War II, that was happening. And then I think everyone might know a story or two about Reno, Nevada, which ended up becoming the divorce ranch, where women could go and get, you know, live there for 6 months and establish residency and then get a quickie divorce and move on from there. In 1969, Ronald Reagan, with pressure from those second wave feminists, declared that irreconcilable differences could be stated as a cause for divorce. And then in the 1970s, the no-fault divorce law was passed, and that really opened the door for the spike in divorces that we saw post-World War II, post-feminist movement. And the last thing I want to mention before we jump into our conversation was that the suffragists who were fighting for the right to vote were also playing with the idea of adding a divorce clause to the Declaration of Sentiments to make it easier for women to separate out from their marriage, because at that time, women were the property of their husbands. They couldn't own land. If they made any money, it went to their husbands. And so Elizabeth Cady Stanton and a lot of the early signers of the Declaration of Sentiments wanted to add that divorce clause and were pushing for something they called free divorce, which was the precursor to what we see today as the no-fault divorce. But that was quickly squashed by a lot of the members of the suffragist movement, because they too saw easy divorce as a path to really diminishing the strength of family in our country. So we're going to talk about divorce 21st century style and some of the things that are changing and some ways that you, if you're going through divorce or have gone through divorce or are struggling to move on after a breakup, might get some help today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can be part of our conversation at 805-781-3875. You can also find me on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. If you'd like, you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast. Go to Apple Podcasts or NPR One, look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, leave a review, and those shows will be up in your devices. You can listen whenever you like. But as always, I'm excited to get to the meat of the conversation. So you are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be right back to start the conversation.
Leaves are falling all around. Time I was on my way. Thanks to you, I'm much obliged. It's such a pleasant stay. But now it's time for me to go. The autumn moon lights my way. But now I smell the rain, and with it pain, and it's heading my way. Sometimes I grow so tired.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and my guest today is Jennifer Blomfield. Jennifer is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She's also a trained divorce coach and child specialist, and she's working with the Slow Collaborative Practice Group here in San Luis Obispo. And I invited Jennifer in today to talk about how things have changed when it comes to divorce since the peak of divorce in the 1970s to where we are today. So thank you for coming in, Jennifer.
It's my pleasure. I always love coming here. So it's interesting how you started the show with some statistics of history. And as Elizabeth said, I work for the Slow Collaborative Practice Group. And collaborative practice traces its roots back to the early 90s when a collaborative approach began, when an attorney named Stu Webb said to his clients that he would no longer go to court. He wanted only to represent his clients in a participatory negotiation process aimed solely at creative settlements. It didn't come to California until early 1994, when lawyers, mental health, and financial professionals began practicing collaborative law. And people want to know, well, what's the difference between just going to court, the old style, mediation, and collaborative divorce? Well, mediation is where the parties are willing to work together, mm-hmm. and one expert, the mediator, is there. Collaborative divorce is where you each have your own lawyer, you each have your own divorce coach, and then you have a neutral child specialist and a neutral financial specialist. But everybody's working together to help these couples uncouple consciously. Mm-hmm. Remember Gwyneth Paltrow? She
yes.
started that
We won't
that
repeat
trend.
That again, though. We'll just let that go.
So, anyway.
To help couples divorce, because we should call it what it is. I don't like to use euphemisms because then it makes it sound softer. A divorce is a divorce. It's a dissolution of a relationship.
It is a dissolution of a marriage. Mm-hmm. It's not always a dissolution of a relationship.
Well said.
If you do creative, collaborative type divorce, you're already co-parenting in the moment, or being a ex-couple, but still being able to communicate in a way that you can possibly communicate afterwards. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes it non-litigious. You're not hating each other. You are creatively working together for the betterment of yourself, your ex-spouse, and your children.
Well, it's interesting because at the turn of the 21st century, so in the last 17 years, 90% of all divorces are settled out of court, which mm-hmm. is a huge change because through 1988, 90% of all cases went to court and continued to be quite contentious. So what brought you into doing this kind of work? Why were you interested, you know, because you're an MFT, and so why the collaborative divorce work?
Well, I had recently, 3 years ago, we have to do education to maintain our license.
Yes.
And something came across my desk where they were looking for mental health professionals to work as divorce coaches and to work as mediation, divorce mediation. And so I took the divorce mediation training and I thought, you know, I feel really good about my clinical experience and skills, but not family law. Mm-hmm. And then I learned about collaborative. And that is perfect for me because it's the whole package.
You don't have to be the expert on
so
the
when,
whole thing.
Yeah, when you do mediation, you'll refer out. But with collaborative law, you don't refer out. Everybody's right there. And everybody's working for the higher purpose. So I got that training, and I got a call from William Powell to join their group. And I have clients now. And I also went into this training right after my own personal divorce. So it was fascinating because I was sitting there in the training, and all the emotion of the divorce was long past. But I thought to myself, oh, if I'd only known this. Mm-hmm. And so a divorce coach is going to prepare their clients to know everything before they even file for divorce.
Because divorce isn't a skill set that we are raised to have.
No.
And so you have to learn it in real time. And so I would imagine having a divorce coach, someone who's been there, knows the process, would be imperative. I am surprised it took us this long to start using coaches to help people through this.
Well, I think it's important because in most marriages or relationships, people have their own role. And it tends to be who's ever better at this will take this role, who's ever better at this will take the mm-hmm. other. And when you find yourself by yourself and you have to be solely responsible for yourself, your finances, your children, your emotional well-being, it can be very overwhelming if you have not learned the other roles. And if you are shocked by certain things in divorce, such as infidelity, you're not even of clear mind
right.
to think of basic things. And you literally need someone to hold your hand and walk you through the steps. Mm-hmm. And we aren't handed a parenting book when we go in the delivery room, and we're not handed a divorce book. But there are parenting books and there are divorce books, but we don't often think about it until it's too late. And that's what a divorce coach does. They really help you understand every single aspect of what it's going to take to become an independent adult and to take care of your emotional well-being through the process and after the process.
Right, because after the paperwork is done, you still have the personal recovery piece and the rebuilding of your life, which can take quite a long time after the divorce is settled. Because when you're going through the process of the divorce, you're still very much actively engaged in that relationship that you had.
Well, and sadly, you're most likely actively engaged in a lot of pain and anger. And that doesn't make for clear decisions. Mm-hmm. And you need someone there to help you self-regulate and remember that there are certain boxes, and each box is going to prepare you. But if you're not of the right mind, you're making poor decisions. And it's my job as a divorce coach to make sure you are making clear decisions.
So there's anthropologist Paul Bohannon created these six stations of divorce that each person goes through, maybe not in order, and maybe they'll go back and revisit them. But he found that you, in order to really be separate and ready to move on as an individual in your own life, you had to go through these six stages. So let's talk about those. The first one is the emotional divorce. And a lot of people go through that emotional divorce long before they ever file any papers. You know, one of the things we talk about in counseling is that one person in the relationship generally is trying really hard to keep things together or get counseling to happen or make things work. And the other person is generally a little resistant. I like things the way they are. Why are you always nagging me? And so interestingly, the person who's the pursuer, who's trying to make change, is the one that quite often will become indifferent. We'll stop trying, we'll lose interest, we'll give up hope. And the person who's been resistant confuses that stopping of nagging or trying as a sign that things are going really well. But the person who is pursuing has gone into an emotional divorce that they kind of give up, separate, move on, and they tend to be the ones that file the divorce papers. And then the person who is resistant is always surprised, and that's when they say, but wait, let's work on this marriage. But unfortunately, when someone becomes indifferent to the relationship, that emotional divorce is really hard to come back from.
Well, that's true. Usually there's one participant that is already left. And so it's really easy for that person to file. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the other person is like a deer in the headlights. So it's, and also, there's both sides to it, because sometimes the person that's the deer in the headlight, what they did in an unhappy marriage is created their own life and filled themselves up with all these activities and my life is perfect. And there was really no tending to the garden. Mm-hmm. So I have to say that both people are very, it's full reciprocity that they are part of this
Absolutely.
Problem. But it is true, once one person is out, it's much easier to make that decision.
Yeah. And it's
and the other person has to catch up. And that's why it's important that you have the support to help you figure out how this happened.
Yes.
And not take it so personally and say, oh, yeah, it happened because it's very clear. It's like we can see it when we see our friends. But we can't see it when it's ourselves.
When you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a side note, that if you are in a relationship that you feel very complacent in, that's generally a sign that things aren't going well in the relationship for one person. Because if you're just rolling along and everything seems to be fine, then you're probably not paying attention to the needs of the other person. And boredom is really the number one reason for divorce. People will say it's infidelity or financial problems or irreconcilable differences. But those three things can all be dealt with if both people are still invested in the relationship, if they still feel impassioned by the relationship or connected or committed to each other. But boredom really is the killer of marriages, where you stop investing the time, or you said tending the garden. So that emotional divorce can happen long before the actual legal divorce, which is stage number two. And that's when you file the paperwork. And so the filing of the paperwork, though, is just the beginning, right?
Well,
or can you file paperwork
you
down farther down the road?
Often people will start marriage counseling at that point. Mm-hmm. And sadly, a lot of times it's almost too late.
Yes, if you get the indifference. You want to go to marriage counseling while you're still fighting with each other to keep things going.
Exactly. And so you file for divorce, and then you have to do all of that work of dividing assets.
Yes, stage three is the economic division divorce.
And that's where things get really difficult. Mm-hmm. Because you file and people just, they're just sort of in limbo. It's sort of like you find out someone dies and you're just kind of in shock and you're just sort of real still. But then everything hits the fan, so to speak. And then you find out things that you don't know anything about in your marriage. And I'm talking about just basic.
Like how to access insurance or how to access bank accounts. And
yeah, so there's your income information. You know, what's your monthly gross, mm-hmm. The commission, your bonuses, your public assistance. Was there a former marriage? Is there spousal support, partner support? Is there pension, retirement? There's social security, disability, all these things that you never really thought about.
Well, because that's the business of marriage. And as you said, couples tend to kind of divide out the chores of marriage so that not one person's doing it all.
And then you have the child custody and the child support. And, I mean, there's all sorts of things. And then there's basic little things like childcare, groceries, utilities, things that you – usually one spouse does do all this. And it's unfortunate that both spouses don't completely know all these things, but I can guarantee you a lot of them do not.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Jennifer Blomfield, a licensed marriage and family therapist, divorce coach, and we're kind of talking about the new modern approach to divorce, and that's collaborative divorce, working with two lawyers, two divorce coaches, two neutral parties to help with
financial
and a child specialist, and that all of these parties come together to help a couple dissolve the relationship and then move on post-divorce. So we're going through the six stations of divorce as recognized by Paul Bohannon, and we talked about emotional divorce, that kind of separating yourself emotionally from the relationship probably long before you go through the legal divorce, and that legal signing of papers, and then the economic divorce, separating all the property. The fourth station is the child custody or the co-parental piece of divorce. And I'm assuming that's where the child specialist would be.
Because you actually, the children really have a say in collaborative divorce.
From what age?
From the very beginning. As long as they can color and draw and play with puppets and they have a voice, because the child specialist can see how the divorce is affecting them. And then we bring that to the table. We often actually have photos of their children, and we have them in the room so that they can see that their children are right here.
And that they're part of this.
They're part of
decision.
Absolutely. Mm. And even adult children. Mm. So in litigation, divorce, you know, if a child is over 18, the law is that you don't really have to provide. But in collaborative, you have a choice if you want to provide. And so we will talk to adult children, and they can request things, you know. And often people want everyone to just get along.
Right. And, you know, don't want to disrupt holidays or weddings or graduations, mm-hmm. to find a way to still carry on those traditions.
And often, I had a very wise supervisor that said, therapy is just reparenting. And we have to reparent ourselves forever. It's mm-hmm. always a growing process. And we can learn more from our kids than anyone else, because they have a bird's eye view of what's really going on.
Yes, they're the truth tellers, mm-hmm. too. The fifth stage of the station of divorce is community divorce. And I think a lot of people don't pay attention to this at all. But when you divorce, it impacts your extended family, grandparents, mm-hmm. cousins, aunts, uncles, but also your neighborhood or your social group or your community, your religious community, your school system, the sports teams your kids play in, like every part of the community that you touched as a family, as a couple, has to adjust once that relationship ends. And that can be really challenging. I mean, we talk a lot about couples choosing who's going to be the one that hangs out, you know, who's going to continue playing bridge or who's the person you're going to invite to the Christmas party. And that can be really emotionally challenging and tough on the community.
Well, and there's a real grieving process similar to the death of a loved one. Mm-hmm. It is a death of a loved one. The person that you chose to marry, you loved more than anyone in the world, and you thought you would spend the rest of your life with them. And when that ends, that is a death. Mm-hmm. And so you have to grieve all aspects, and part of that is the social. Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult. And in time, it gets easier, and you can go to events and see your ex, and things are fine. But that's personal work that must follow during and after a divorce. That's essential, because otherwise you will hold bitterness, and the mm-hmm. only person that gets hurt from bitterness and anger is the person holding it. It doesn't really affect the person on
who's
the other
moved
side.
On.
Yes, so those things are important to always have that support, and it doesn't have to be a divorce coach. It can be a friend. It can be, you know, a colleague, it can be a pastor, but having someone that can help you through those times where you really feel bad and you need to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And then the final station of divorce is the psychological station. And I think statistically, this is where a lot of people get stuck. And I think you were alluding to that just then, that you can go through all of the legal pieces of divorce and child custody and separate the assets, but a lot of couples have a hard time psychologically disconnecting themselves from the other. That they, you know, if you're parents, you always share your children. But the other piece is that identity you had as being part of that couple, or that, you know, future plan that you had in your mind, or that history that you shared together, that it's the most difficult to let go of that psychological bond and to psychologically become your own individual person again. And talk about that process.
Well, whenever there's attachment or enmeshment, we know those words as sometimes can not be very healthy. There's a difference between helping and enabling. And if you haven't been able to separate that once you leave a relationship, then you are going to have those problems. You really have to always see yourself as a separate human being that's in union with someone, whether it's at your work or your child, or a friend, or a spouse. But you also have to be a separate person from that. And if you're not, if your life is attached to that identity, or that job, or that person, then you are not really a whole developed human being. And that is what we certainly strive for in our life. And that's what causes people unhappiness, because they're thinking, well, if he hadn't left me, or if she hadn't left me, or if this hadn't happened. Well, life happens, and you have to adjust, adapt, and then learn how to develop coping skills, self-nurturing skills.
Basically, and to be solo.
Yeah, and and there are so many of us. I am sitting here as a solo person who is very, very happy. It took me a while. It took me a good 2 years after my divorce to feel that.
And that's important to understand, that it's not weeks or months we're talking about. The recovery process can be years.
Well, I think someone threw out a statistic. It's a year for every 5 years you're together. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in a long marriage, you've already spent 5 years separating before you file. But it's difficult, because it's like someone took your arm off and suddenly you don't have an arm. Mm-hmm. And it's soul splitting, and you've got to bring all those little pieces back. And you also have to find out, who were you before you met this person? Mm-hmm. And what part of that disappeared? Bringing that person back.
Well, and it's interesting, because I'm hearing you talk about, you know, the separating and having your autonomous person. And I think what's challenging is that in long-term, strong, healthy marriages, those relationships are enmeshed. And they're strong, healthy relationships. That's one of the things that kind of sets a strong, healthy marriage apart, is that those couples will say that their favorite company is their spouse, that they'd rather spend time together than with other people, that most of their spare time they spend together. And so the story that we kind of told post-1970s big divorce rates, you know, a lot of throwing out of terms like enmeshment and enabling, you know, those terms all were kind of brought about to help with the divorce culture. But what people don't talk about is that when it works well in a marriage, that's what makes a marriage strong. And I think that's why divorce is so crushing, because if you're really invested and committed to a marriage, you're all in. You are engaged with that person. They are your arm.
But but you're talking about two healthy people.
Yes, and a healthy, well, committed relationship.
Right. They're not all marriages are healthy committed relationships.
But I think that's what makes the conversation challenging, because a lot of people who are in healthy relationships start to feel like they need to be more autonomous, which doesn't help the, you know, I think there's a lot of it depends in these conversations. You know, it depends, are two healthy people. You might have thought you were in a healthy relationship and then things shifted and then it all comes apart. And so as a result, a lot of people will say, well, here's the solution. Cause this is what happened post 70s divorce peak. A lot of parents raised their kids with this idea. Never give yourself fully to another person. You don't want to be blindsided like I was in my marriage. Always have your own money. Always be ready to bail. Never be fully trusting. And all of that kind of well-intended advice that divorced parents gave to their children is part of the reason why we have a secondary high divorce rate in those children, because they go into the marriage already ready for it to fail. And so I think that, from a clinician's point of view, is the challenge. How do we teach those healthy marriage skills, relational skills, bonding skills, attachment skills, but not let people get lost in it and not set them up for divorce by never fully engaging in the relationship. It's a tough dance.
It is a tough dance, but when people respect one another for who they are and not expect them to change, so many people expect people to change in a relationship. But if you really look at the person for who they are and love what they are, even in the good and bad times, mm-hmm. like when someone works for 30 years and then retires, there's going to be a huge shift in that person's life.
And identity.
And the spouse has to understand that big developmental life change mm-hmm. and be supportive of that. And, you know, you can't say to people, buck up. You have to, like, kind of ride them through it.
Right.
When you ask a woman to give up a career, or when a woman chooses to give up a career to be a stay-at-home mom, then when that child is grown and they go, ah, now I get to go back to my career, that's a huge change mm-hmm. for the other spouse when they're just hitting retirement. But once you navigate that, and I know you've shared with me that you've had that experience in your own marriage, and once you navigate that, it actually, there's no time for boredom. Right. Marriage is always an interesting, it's always in flux.
And I think that's why the divorce conversation is challenging, because a lot of times people say, how do you know when you're done? Because the rule of thumb on one end is you keep trying, you keep putting in time, you'll find your way back to the way things were, and that happens. But there are times that it's not going to come back, that it is going to be over. And so I think that's where we're going to pick up. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're talking about divorce, 21st century style. My guest is Jennifer Blomfield, and you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to open the phone lines and take your calls, 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you have a question or comment you'd like to make. And so, Jennifer, if someone has gotten to that point where they've put in their all, they've come to the end, and they've chosen divorce, and they decide a divorce coach is going to be helpful, what happens when they call you? What? because first they have to feel safe enough to call you. Making that phone call takes a lot of courage. But once they've made that call to you, what do you do? How do you jump into this?
Well, first of all, I ask them if they're looking for a divorce coach, a divorce mediator, or are they a part of a collaborative divorce? And
but
I
would
explain
someone, but would
all
someone
of those.
Know that? Okay.
No, so I explain all of that to okay. them. And let's say they say, okay, we are in a collaborative or we're in mediation. We want you as our divorce coach. And so as a divorce coach, I'll help them develop an action plan in order to move forward. I'm going to help them develop a plan for talking to their children about the divorce. And I'm going to refer them to therapeutic professionals if needed. If they're in collaborative, they'll already have their lawyer and their financial professional. I may refer them to a realtor, you know, if they need to sell their house. And then I'll also give them an action plan on guidance after the divorce.
Do you actually do the therapy yourself, though?
We do not do therapy.
Okay.
So a coach is different than a therapist. Now, obviously, we use our therapeutic skills, and when we're in the collaborative room with everyone, you are doing – a divorce coach does a lot of work with self-regulation, where we want to keep the spouses calm so that they can negotiate. Mm-hmm. And so if something comes up and the emotions get really high, we'll take them outside or we have little things that we do with them. I actually use EMDR paddles as a divorce coach, which is eye movement desensitization deprocessing, mm-hmm. big long word. But it really is a bilateral stimulation that self-regulates, takes you out of the amygdala, fight or flight, and sort of calms you down. Because we all get triggered in this process. But I spend a lot of time with them talking about what it's going to be like when we go in the room. Mm-hmm. And I ask them, have you met with your financial? Have you met with your lawyer? Have you finished all of this?
So you're kind of holding them accountable in some
ways.
I'm
holding them accountable. And then I've actually written scripts for them when they are so overwhelmed on how to approach someone or their child. I also have their children come in, and I keep things confidential with their kids, but I'm able to report back to the parents on what their children's needs are or what's showing up. And then also to tell them that what their kids are feeling is perfectly normal. Mm-hmm. I mean, their kids are also in crisis. Mm-hmm. And especially if they're acting out and they're angry, that's all part of it. And I remind the parents what good parents they are, or they wouldn't be here. So I usually try to normalize it so that they can understand that they're not going crazy. Mm-hmm. And that it is doable and that everyone's going to be fine, but it's not going to be tomorrow or the next day.
And do you work with the other divorce coach? Because you had said in the collaborative, each spouse has a divorce coach. So do you work with that other? Like, how much do you work with the other?
The collaborative team, mm-hmm. which is the two lawyers, the two divorce coaches, and the financial neutral, we all meet together before we bring everyone in. So yeah, there's a lot of collaborative work, and because we're all on the side of the couple having a divorce that is going to cost them less money and where they actually have a say in the outcome. Because when you go to court, it is the judge that's going to have the say, and even the lawyers will say, we're not sure how the judge will decide. Mm-hmm. So nobody really knows. In collaborative and in mediation, you know exactly how it's going to end because the couple are the passengers and we are the pilots. They're telling us where to land and we get them there safely.
And so you're a child specialist also. And let's talk a little bit about the impact of divorce on children, because one of the questions I get often from people is, is there a good time for divorce? You know, when is there a good time in my child's life for a divorce? Is it going to be okay? How do we navigate that? So let's talk about the...
Well, each child, you know, depending on their age, because there's different developmental stages and how they're going to respond to things. And so I sit down with the parents and I actually give them handouts on their child's age and what to expect.
Mm-hmm. And what they can comprehend, I guess, developmentally.
Yes. And, you know, for little kids, you know, there's the fear of abandonment.
Right.
Is someone going
right.
to leave? There's that horrible uncertainty about their future. There's the magical thinking, you know, where a child will think it's their fault.
Right.
And then, you know, with teenagers, there's resistance, there's apathy, there's high emotions, and then there's acting out and hating their parents. All of it's normal. I mean, you've got two parents that are fighting. I mean, everybody's going to, and yet everyone's different. So the divorce coach is going to meet with these kids and see where those kids are at, because you could have three teenagers and the three of them may be responding differently. And we're trying to let everyone know your needs have been heard, mm-hmm. and we're going to express this. And then when we have their pictures there, the parents want the best for their children. I think that's the one thing that they can both agree on.
Hopefully. But, of course, there is the, you know, parental alienation syndromes, and there's kind of high emotion. When you talked about the high emotions that people get into, that sometimes parents in their anger at the other spouse will do things that will hurt the children.
Well, often if it's a high conflict divorce, it's usually not collaborative or
mediation. Right, you're not going to see them anyway.
And that's when you hope there's enough money for therapy for everybody.
Well, and that's the other thing, too, is I love the idea of using the coach with the collaboration, keeping the parents in charge, right? Keeping the parents educated so that they can make the decisions, have the conversations with their children to help them move along. Because I always am concerned when parents who are getting divorced instantly throw their kids in therapy as if that's somehow going to help the kids. And really what it does at first is make kids feel like they're sick or broken.
No, often it's the parents that need
yes,
therapy.
The parents need to go to therapy so they can learn the skills to talk with their kids. Please don't just throw your kids in therapy, because that instantly makes them feel like they're broken. Down the road, though, you know, therapy can be helpful as a family coming back together. So let's also talk about some of the custody arrangements, because I'm hearing more and more about nesting and parents that are maintaining the family home that the kids stay in, mm-hmm. and the parents have separate residences, and so they take turns coming in and out of the family home. Is that becoming more common, or is that still just rare?
No, that usually works best during the separation phase.
Okay.
And because money, the financial piece really answers a lot of the questions. And that's what I always tell everyone. Meet with your financial person first, because once you know what you can afford, you won't know if you can get two houses. Mm-hmm. And the nesting part is where you have a studio apartment and the main house is where the children stay all the time. And then the spouses take turns going to the other place. That can work, but most people really want their own space. And if they don't really like their spouse, they don't want them in their space.
Right.
So you have to have all those conversations. But really what it boils down to is, can you afford two homes?
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Jennifer Blomfield, divorce coach, licensed marriage and family therapist. She is a member of the Slow Collaborative Practice Group. And if people were interested in learning more about it, how do they get in touch with you or the collaborative group?
My website is divorceslow.com. Mm-hmm. And the Slow Collaborative Practice Group is slowcpg.com. And on both of those websites, you will find the entire collaborative team. And then on divorceslow.com, you will see just my website and what I do.
It's interesting when the conversation about children and if there's an okay time to get divorced. And you said everything all depends on, you know, what the children were experiencing prior to the divorce. It's interesting, but children in high contentious marriages are oftentimes relieved when the parents divorce,
mm-hmm.
because
yes.
the home has been so contentious and uncomfortable and disruptive and anxiety provoking that the divorce becomes kind of a relief.
Yeah, adolescents and adult children
Yes.
Most often say that.
Yes. That it's more a relief. Yeah, mm-hmm. For little children.
And most kids that are well-balanced go, yeah, I love both of my parents, but this is their drama. And they're pretty clear about it.
Yes, take it elsewhere.
You know, and if the parents don't drag the kids in to take sides, children want their parents to be happy. And when they're happy, they're happy. You know, the kids are happy.
Everyone does better.
But it takes time because they also don't want to see their parents hurting. And it's always a tough time, even in the healthiest families. Mm-hmm. But it can be done. And that's why it's always nice to have that support to help you through it.
And it's interesting also that for couples that end up getting divorced and there was no contention, they say, we never fought. That can be actually more traumatic for children.
Yes.
And I just want to put that out there that just because you stop fighting and you say, we're just going to stay together till the kids grow up and you just don't speak to each other, that's in ways more damaging to the kids because they read that something's wrong just because you're not speaking to each other. You know, they sense it or they don't sense it and they think that you get along great and you're just biding your
and
time.
And then you believe that everything you ever believed in was a big lie.
It was a lie.
And so the whole thing was a myth. So that's very traumatic. And then you're trying to figure out, wait a minute, what did that all mean? And it's unfortunate, but these things do happen.
It seems like in all things mental health, communication is the key. Being able to be honest first with ourselves at what we're feeling and experiencing, and then being able to be honest with the people that we care most for. And, you know, the underlying guiding principle for life should be living our life in a way that supports our mental health and well-being and the mental health and well-being of those we care about and are responsible mm-hmm. for. And if we were to keep those things in our forefront, you know, I think decisions wouldn't be easy, but they'd be
transparency and accountability mm-hmm. without self disclosing details. It's lying that causes people so much trauma because they're going, what? Because they think one thing and it's really another thing.
But let's also make sure that we don't encourage you to spill your marital
stories
to your children.
Self-disclose. No.
Ever.
You don't ever disclose details. Yeah.
No matter how old they are, mm-hmm. if they're your adult children, they don't want to hear about those marital details. And that's
they've, they've lived enough of those marital details. They don't need to.
They don't need to hear more. Right. They don't want to hear. And let's finish up the show talking about that psychological divorce, that moving forward, that creating a life post the divorce that can be one that you thrive in, that your ex thrives in. Talk a bit about that. What is the best outcome?
Well, when you are healing from wounds, I think what people forget is that when life happens, it's how we react to it that either causes us unhappiness or helps us to move forward. And when we take responsibility for our own feelings and know that some people can move on quickly and other people will stay wounded longer, once you know that it's your responsibility and not someone else's fault, that makes the emotional divorce easier to move through. It's when we hold blame with others that we can't move on. And so that's the work that people have to do privately and on their own and not include. That's not something you can do as a couple or as a family. You must do
or
that
with
on
your children.
Own. Oh, well,
please
definitely not with your children.
But some of the healing things that people can do, you know, when we talk about psychological divorce, we're talking about having to change the way you do your life, change your hair color, change the food you eat, change the television shows you watch. I want to give specific tools is that when we talk about changing your day to day, when you go through a divorce or the end of a relationship, you literally have to recreate a new normal, a new homeostasis, and you have to bring your psyche along to understanding that this change has occurred. And so you do those actual things. Take an exercise class that you've never taken before, right? You have to start creating new habits that have nothing to do with your old
and
life.
And sometimes to break old habits, you have to practice doing something you haven't done before just to get yourself out of that rut.
Yes.
And so there's all those wonderful, healthy distractions that you just said. And because just crawling under the blanket and staying there, that's not going to get you anywhere except, bed sores.
Yeah. It feels good for a little while, but at some point that moving forward can start to be exciting because you'll start discovering things about yourself that, you know, although the marriage might have been a great home for a long time, you as a separate person have discovered new things about yourself, new capacities, your ability to pay bills and deal with insurance and deal with cable companies that might seem like little things but are huge triumphs.
And once you learn all those basics, then organically you start to find joy in life. Mm-hmm. And people are usually very happy before they get married. And people can be very happy when they are unmarried. There's a lot of joy in life as a person without a spouse. And there's so many wonderful things to do, and I'm living proof of it. I have a fabulous life, and I have great children, and I have a wonderful relationship.
So tell me two things you discovered about yourself since the divorce that surprised you.
Well, as a woman who's turning 64 next week, I have discovered that I am a beautiful woman who still loves life and loves to dance and loves to sing and still is playful and works with young people. And I don't feel like a senior citizen. I feel very much alive, and I am thrilled to think that I still have 35 more years of life and that I'm going to still be working. I would say that is the best thing. And I'm starting to get my voice back, my singing voice. I think that was the one thing I had to give up. And that's a big part of my life.
My guest today has been Jennifer Blomfield. She is a divorce coach, a licensed marriage and family therapist. If you're interested in finding out more about a divorce coach or a slow collaborative practice group, you can go to divorceslow.com. And find Jennifer's website and all the information. And then for the Slow Collaborative Practice Group, it's slowcpg.com. Thank you for being my guest today. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast this show. Pass it on to others. Find us at thereluctanttherapist.com. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. As always, I appreciate you being part of this community and listening to Central Coast Public Radio KCBX. We'll be back next week for more conversations. Until then, a little Dust Bowl revival.